Please help me to welcome Ann is from the Burlington Young People's Group from Burlington, Vermont. Ann?
My name is Ann. I'm an alcoholic. There's a lot of you guys here tonight. I'm from the Burlington Young People Group. We meet Sunday nights at 6:30. Nice little place, nice quiet meeting. We recently had our year anniversary, and we started this meeting, and there was average about 10 people, and we just had about 90 people show up for our anniversary party. And, you know, it blows my mind because it's this group that, like, the average age in the room is about 25, and the best thing about it is we talk about the big book, we talk about God, we talk about the 12 steps. In our group conscience meetings, we talk about the 12 traditions. We would probably talk about the 12 concepts, but not much of us know about them yet, or that much about them, which I'm kind of embarrassed to say. But the closer we stick to the 36 principles, the more the group flourishes and the stronger we grow. And I think that's a true testament for what really Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer us, a life of freedom and a life of happiness, a life I never dreamed that I would ever have. My sobriety date is March 7th, 2005. God separated me from alcohol, not because I wanted to stop drinking, but because I really believe that my Heavenly Father decided that was the time where I was going to get sober. I will throw out a real quick announcement. There's a Vision for You men's intensive camp out in Vermont. It's right by Bill Wilson's house that we're putting together this summer. There's a flyer somewhere over there. It'd be great to have a lot of you guys from Pennsylvania come up. It's going to be a really cool deal. So, what was it like, what happened, and what is it like today? Man, I grew up, it's really cool that I got to come down here. I grew up right outside of Fogelsville, in between Fogelsville and New Chipoli. And Jeff asked me to speak down here right around Christmas time, and when there was an open spot, I was basically back in Vermont, and I wasn't able to just turn around and drive back down. And I said, well, why can't we do it around, like, Mother's Day or something like that? And it worked out really well where, you know, I was able to come down here, celebrate Mother's Day, celebrate my father's birthday, and then come be of service with this group. And what it was like is, you know, I grew up on this farm. I'm not a farm type of guy. I never wanted to be a farm type of guy. My dad wanted me to be a farm type of guy. I wanted to be a skateboarder, snowboarder, rip it up at the hills of Blue Mountain. That's what I wanted to do, and man, that was about it. I'm an only child. My parents are probably the two most wonderful people I've ever met in my entire life. My mother, when she drinks alcohol, she likes margaritas, and I really like margaritas. But when she drinks a margarita, like, something happens, and her cheeks get real red, and she starts to laugh a lot and giggle. Maybe we'll have another one, and then starts to get really annoying and start saying inappropriate things and asking me things that a mother shouldn't be asking her son. And, you know, she stops drinking, and that's that. You know, she's feeling it, she's cool, she's happy where she is, and that's that. My dad, every day when he comes home from work, he has two Yingling lager, and then around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock before dinner, he has a Bloody Mary and or a vodka tonic. That's it. 4 drinks. I've heard some stories from my dad when he was in Vietnam, and he definitely liked to tie it on. So did my mom. My mom tried to climb a tree with a Volkswagen once. she says she was tired, but she was at the bar, coincidentally. But see, they, for some reason, were able to stop or moderate. Now, no one taught me how to stop or moderate for some reason. And when I take a drink of alcohol, I start to get thirsty. And the more I drink, the thirstier I get. and it's like I get this unquenchable thirst that, oh, it just is so good. And the problem is, I get very violent when I drink. I tend to black out almost every time. Then people tell me all the stupid, ridiculous things I do once I black out. I'd like to tell you about them, but I don't really remember any of them. I have heard people who proceed to talk about how they black out all the time they drink and then tell you these stories from when they were blacked out, and I don't understand how that works. But when I black out, I black out. My war story basically is I've got 9 arrests. 2 of those are DUIs. I do all these absurd, incredible, tragic things when I'm under the influence of alcohol. And I wake up and I say, I'm not doing that. I can't cause the harm. I mean, I've ripped doors off my parents' house. I've been in fistfights with my dad. My mother was dying in Lehigh Valley Hospital. I walked in, I kissed her on the cheek, and I left to go get loaded because I was already drinking on the way in. I don't want to hurt these people, but for some reason, like, when I put that one drink in my body, I need another drink. And the more I drink, the thirstier I get. And the thirstier I get. And the thirstier I get. And finally, I get some area to breathe. Correction says, Ian, you can't drink anymore. So I don't drink. I stop drinking. I put the plug in the jug. Things are cool. But then this thought crosses my mind, and it says, well, you can probably have one. You've been sober for a little while now. And I think, well, you know what? That's a really good idea. So I have just one. And then this physical craving takes over, and I'm off and running all over again. The first time I really felt any severe consequences from my drinking was I was 14 years old. I had 2 20-ounce soda bottles. One was vodka and orange juice, which now I know is a screwdriver. Right before, it was called vodka and orange juice, as far as I was concerned. The other one was a third of it was gin, and the rest of it was white wine. And we were going on a field trip, so I wanted to have enough to take with me on this field trip. And I drank the orange juice vodka one on the way to the bus, and I got on the bus, and I was feeling good. And now somebody on my school bus ratted me out to the principal, but there was no proof. So the principal went around to every single classroom, and I remember when he came into my classroom, he gave the same spiel in every one. But when he came into mine, I was sitting in the back of the room on a table. I was too cool to sit in the desks. And he looks in the back and he says, if anyone has alcohol on this trip and we find it, you will be expelled. And he was looking right at me. And I thought, well, that's great for everyone else, but you aren't going to catch me. I can do this. What I didn't know is that since I was already drinking, this physical craving was taking over, and I didn't have a choice whether I was going to drink. I didn't have power. I didn't have control. Any intelligent person would be like, well, okay, you're going to get in trouble. Don't do that. So what happened? I get on the bus, and I open up the container, and we're in this really, one of those nice, fancy buses things, not the regular school bus. And I take off the top. Oh, and it's bad. I mean, we're talking gin and white wine, and it's bad. But you know what? It feels kind of good. And I start drinking for the effect that alcohol has on me. I can't differentiate the true from the false. Like, I don't know that, you know what, this is going to be bad news, you're going to get yourself in trouble. I believe the false, which is no one's going to know. So I try to get a few of the buddies in the back to drink it. They take a sip or two, and they're like, whoa, this is disgusting, what are you doing? And I'm like, no, but you don't get it. Like, this is really good, let's drink some more. And I end up finishing it. I get extremely, extremely violent. I know, because I looked at the bathroom, they made me clean it, it was a mess. I do remember being in some sort of, like, stretcher, gurney type thing. And I remember running around with my friends, and that's really what I remember of the day. My father, wow, there's probably, I don't know how many years ago that was, but my father had to come to school to get me the day I was expelled on his birthday, which was the 13th of May. I proceeded to go to military school, Valley Forge Military Academy. They kicked me out of there too. I got into some other substances, out of rubber cement. Anything for the effect, I was looking for that effect. But really, we were able to get booze a few times there, but we weren't able to get it as much as we wanted. I proceeded to get kicked out of there, back up into Northwestern. I somehow squeaked through. I'm the only student, I think, in Northwestern Lehigh High School who ever graduated with not taking a single day of a language. Manipulated my way in, manipulated my way out, played the system, get in trouble, go to the Votech school, get kicked out of the Votech school, back. They're sick and tired of me. They kick me out. Well, they push me out, I should say. I graduate high school second or third from last out of 200 kids. Well, that's fabulous. Through the course of this time, when I was 14, I started seeing a drug and alcohol counselor. And they recommended I should go to AA. Now, I'm 14 years old, and there's no way I'm an alcoholic. There's no way I'm going to AA. If I want to stop, I will anytime I'm good and ready. I'm just not ready yet. It's interesting, in the big book, it talks about many of the young people were encouraged to stop, but they can't because of the strange mental twist. See, I had these mental twists already, and I didn't even know it. I had the physical craving, but I thought I just liked to get really drunk. And I eventually, this stuff just progressed, I started to get in trouble for stealing so I could get booze. This drug and alcohol counselor says, if you go to college, you can leave Nutripoli. And I said, well, how do I get to college? What do I got to do? Show me who I need to talk to. I make my way into college, and I really went to college so I could go snowboarding. That's why I went to Vermont. I moved to Burlington, Vermont in 2000, September of that year. And I became an entrepreneur extremely quick. I got into all these exciting activities. I arranged my classes so I would only have classes Tuesday and Thursday. So I had 5 days a week to party. I would always, I would pull it together for the Tuesday and Thursday that I had to go to class. But somewhere in the middle of the day, I would get thirsty. So I would run back to my dorm and I would take a drink. And as soon as I would take that drink, the rest of the day, the only thing I could think about was what was I going to do that night? How was I going to get more beer? Who was I going to party with? Who was I going to hang out with? Who was I going to be with? I would get out of my classes, I would proceed to drink for the next day, and then pull it together, go to classes again, and then I would have a few days to just go on a tear. That proceeded, I started following bands around the country, taking my entrepreneur business on the road. I got arrested all over. I've been in jail in Philly, New Jersey, Vermont, Hartford. I can't not drink alcohol. I don't get it. I was put on probation once when I was 16, and I was supposed to be on probation for 6 months. That 6 months turned into one trip to juvenile detention, 2 trips to house arrest, and 4 years later, I finally got off probation. 6 months went by, I got put back on probation for getting another DUI. I can't not drink alcohol. For me, not drinking alcohol is not even an option. Why would you want to be sober? That doesn't make sense to me. And these antics just continue, I go through college, I'm getting a bachelor's degree in social work, I want to be a substance abuse counselor, I'm going to these freaking substance abuse counselor trainings, all sorts of loaded from this other substance. The second I get out, I'm getting booze and I'm on a tear. 2003, I don't really remember it. Major bad things happened in Philadelphia as a result of my drinking. For years, there was an incident. I remembered crashing my car in Philly and calling my mom and demanding her pick me up from some treatment center somewhere, I don't know where, somewhere around here. And that's all I remembered. And eventually I talked to my mom about this, and it was like an elapse of like 6 months in between those 2 days where I went back to Vermont and I continued to go to school. And I lived in a blackout because I was only living the dream. You know, I didn't know that there was a different way of life, and I didn't know there was another way. So it gets, it's somewhere around 2003, and things are really bad, and I go to this Phish concert, and it's a two-day deal. I'm there for 7 days. I'm camping. I'm having a grand old time. I'm working security. I'm sleeping 2 hours a night, partying all day long. The last song, something hit me. A roommate who overdosed at one point was about to overdose again. And I started to cry hysterically, and I said, I'm never doing this stuff again. Like, I can't. Like, I can't live like this. All my friends are so loaded, they're all around me, and like, I can't even get drunk now. You know, I'm 20, maybe 1 years old, maybe 22, and like, I've been drinking all day long, and I don't even have a buzz. I'm wondering why, maybe like someone gave me non-alcoholic beer or something, and I don't get it, and everyone else is so loaded. And I start to get worried, and I start to get upset, so I quit, and I throw my pipe, and I pour out the booze. We pack up, we go home the next day, and somewhere along the line, my high resolve disappeared, and I started to drink again. All that stuff progressed and progressed and progressed. Towards the end of my drinking, I was told I was extremely violent. My apartment, when I moved out of it, you would have to, you would remove like the pictures, and I was big into framing these concert pictures, and there would be holes behind them because I would just start punching things. If I didn't get my way, I would throw something across the room. It didn't matter what it was, but I would throw it. I was teaching preschool while this was happening, and everyone always laughed at that. I don't know why. So I'm teaching preschool while this is happening, and somewhere along the line, I demanded these pills from a doctor, because when I would, as I would sleep through the night, and maybe some of you will identify this, I would change my shirt at least 2 or 3 times because I would just sweat profusely. And I would wake up in the morning, and I would be so jittery, and I would be crawling inside, and I would have this anxiety that I just wanted to jump out of my skull. And I would go to the doctor and explain him this stuff, and he would say, well, how much do you drink? And I would say, well, a couple. He would say, okay, why don't you maybe do this or that? And I said, no, I want these pills because I've taken them before and they make me feel better. What I now know is it's a pill that they give people for detox. So in the morning, before I go to preschool, I pop a couple pills, I take a shower, slug off the Listerine, and I go to school. Throughout the day, I start to get drowsy from the meds that he gives me for the, quote, anxiety. Otherwise known as detox. So I started taking these other pills, which is basically pharmaceutical cocaine. I'm running around through the day. As soon as I get out of work, I run to that store. I grab myself at least a 12-pack, and I just drink with a vengeance. Because it's the only thing that really makes me feel okay is this alcohol. I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink. And one day, I don't know, I was going to court for my second DUI, and there was this bubbly little bastard of a guy, the only other guy teaching preschool. He was annoying. He really was. I'm real good friends with him today, but he was really annoying. And he's got long hair and a ponytail. I got long hair and a ponytail. I weigh 40 pounds less than I weigh right now. My skin is like grayish green. I got these black circles around my eyes. I'm a complete mess. And he's reading this book called Daily Reflections. And now, I know everything there is to know about spirituality, so I thought. Seriously, I traveled to India. I flew to India. I was there for 3 days. I studied Buddhism. Or not 3 days, 3 weeks. I swear to God, I meditated with the monks in the Himalayas. I mean, I was all over India, really learning Buddhism, these spiritual practices. I, at one point, had crystals, and I meditated with crystals and used the metaphysics. At one point, I had dreadlocks and prayed to Haile Selassie. I've seen Jesus Christ on an acid trip. I thought that was... God, and then I thought I was God, and I thought I made that happen. But in all seriousness, like, I was really trying to seek this spiritual way of life. Like, I was trying to look for something better. Like, I knew there was a better way of life. I was raised Lutheran. I went to the Lutheran church. As soon as I got in trouble for getting high outside the back, my mom said, "You don't have to go anymore." Then I would stay home and sip off the booze out of their fridge while they would go to church. You know, I was always seeking, but never found. What I didn't know is it was right in front of me this whole time. And as I read this daily reflection that this guy has in the morning, I think, wow, a lot of this stuff is really cool. But then, like, wait a second, whatever these step things are, I don't understand that. But, like, whatever else they're talking about is cool. And it's around February, so it's all, you know, came to believe, restore me to sanity. Like, I can dig that. Like, that's cool. Like, I got it. All right, let's give me more of this. So every day I start to look forward to reading this daily reflection. And he says I was pretty crazy then. I don't really remember much of it. But somewhere along the line, he said, "Why don't you come with me to an AA meeting?" And I was like, "Dude, like, you're younger than I am. I'm 23. Like, I don't need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, what? I'm not even an alcoholic. I mean, maybe I got a problem with this other stuff, but, like, I quit that over New Year's and I haven't touched it since. Like, I'm cool. Like, I don't, whatever." I said, "I'm going to quit for good. Like, I'm done. I'm in the middle of my second DUI. Like, I'm about to be 23. I can't do this anymore. I swear off booze forever." And I went snowboarding. I judged a snowboard competition. My parents came to Vermont to watch the competition, celebrate my birthday. I turned 23. They left. I had a dog at the time. I couldn't take care of. I really tried, but I wasn't good at it. They took the dog home. That night, it was the 6th of March, my parents left, and me and a buddy were going out. He wanted to take me out for my birthday. And I said, "Cool, no problem." And I said, "But I don't want to go anywhere that's going to serve alcohol, because I don't want to drink, and I really got to stay sober this time. Like, I can't not drink." So we went to this one place, and it was Sunday night, and it was closed. And then we went to this other place, and that was closed. And we went to this other place, and finally we said, "Screw it, we'll go into Coyote's Cafe." Now, Coyote's Cafe sold the best margaritas. I would get them with Patron tequila. That was my drink of choice, Patron. I absolutely loved tequila. Preferably I would drink tequila on the rocks and then take shots of tequila, if I had it up to me. If not that, then I would drink scotch. And we were walking in this restaurant, and I remember this like it was yesterday. I'm walking in, and we're talking about how I'm not going to drink, and he says, "Are you sure you're going to be cool?" And I was like, "Man, I got this. Like, I'm not going to drink. Like, it's not a big deal." And we're walking in, and we sit down, and we're still talking about it, and the waitress comes over, and we're talking about it, and next thing I know, I'm ordering my second pitcher of margaritas. The first one is right in front of me with one straw gone. He's looking at me like I'm completely delusional. I'm kind of confused. She brings the other one out. I suck it down with maybe three gulps. These are, you know, big pitchers. These aren't like little dinky things. They're made for two or three people at least. And, like, I don't even have the slightest buzz. And I'm confused about how I just did that when I swore I wasn't going to do it. See, I thought I had a choice. Like, I thought that my willpower was sufficient to keep me sober. I mean, I couldn't remember what happened 2 days ago, let alone what am I going to do if I stay sober for 4 years. If I can't bring into my consciousness the sufficient force of yesterday, how the hell am I going to stay sober today? Maybe I should just not drink. Maybe I should put the plug in the freaking jug. But see, if I could just do those things, I wouldn't have had all these problems. With sufficient force, I would have got sober a long time before I did. Because I wanted the nonsense to stop. I just wanted to be happy. So what would I do? I would pick up another drink. I was living in a state of delusion where I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. I didn't know that there was another way. I didn't know I couldn't not drink. I thought that all I had to do to not drink was say, "I'm not drinking anymore," and just not touch it. So I go home, I go back to work the next day, and this guy says, "Sal, how'd it go not drinking?" And I said, "Well, screw you, it didn't go very good." And he says, yeah, I knew you were going to drink. And he thought it was pretty funny, but I was pretty pissed. And he says, so why don't you come to an AA meeting? I went to an AA meeting, March 7, 2005. It was on step 3 out of the big book, and I shared and I told them how I knew everything about spirituality. I had one of my crystals with me. It was one that meant the stone of courage. I was ready to rumble. I was ready to do this thing. But most importantly, what happened in that meeting was that it talks about it more about alcoholism. Like, they started to relate their experiences. And from that moment, for some reason, I knew that my alcoholic dilemma was fixed right there. That maybe something they had to offer me. See, I thought when I was going to go into AA that everyone was going to be old and glum and boring and whatever else. But they weren't. The majority of them were my age, and there was really only 4 or 5 of them in that room. 10 tops. But they started to talk about their experiences. And then they would relate the third step, and like, I knew that they knew how I felt. I mean, I was seeing drug and alcohol counselors who were telling me ways to stay sober from the time I was 14 to the time I was 21, and none of them worked. I swore off booze for good. I tried everything. One of the nights that I didn't take any credit cards to the bar or debit cards, I specifically put them in my drawer, both my credit card and my debit card. I took $20 to the bar. I wake up on the floor in jail. They give me my little baggie with my credit card and my debit card. I've got a receipt from one of the bars, and where I was supposed to sign it, it said F you. It was for $165. Apparently, I drank a bottle of Patron out of shots. It's very expensive at the bar. I pick up my cell phone, and on my cell phone, there's a message from the owner of the bar that says, if I ever see you here again, you're done. Now, mind you, when that happened, I was like 21, 22 tops. I was banned from a bar when I was 20 for smashing people's glasses. I was walking into them, apparently. I don't remember any of it. And so the story goes, I did a whole bunch of stupid, ridiculous things on the way out the bar. And I lost my train of thought. So basically, whatever, not important. I cannot drink. I identify with these people. They tell me to get a sponsor. I say, what's a sponsor? They say, someone to help you stay sober. I look over at my annoying little buddy. I said, would you sponsor me? He said, yes. I set out to be the number one president of Alcoholics Anonymous right there and then. And I almost had it, too. I got a big book. They gave me a big book. They gave me a 12 and 12. They didn't say it's $6. They didn't say it's $5. They said, here, take these, read them. I went home and thumbed around a little bit. Started going to meetings. I remember my friend, like maybe day 3 of sobriety, says, you know, if you don't like me as a sponsor, you can get somebody else. That night I got somebody else. And I started working the steps with this guy. And May 7th, I went to my college graduation. I thanked the cop who followed me and gave me my last DUI. He happened to be there. He followed me and got me arrested, basically. I thanked him for that opportunity. I was 2 months sober. I was staying sober on the fellowship. I was actively working the steps. I did my 4-step, and I had my little check boxes, and I was checking away, and then he said, write the fears, and I write the fears, and do this, and I do that, and this girl who I was seeing, who was like 12 years older than me, 11 years older than me, she thought she was pregnant. I went into crisis mode, oh my God, I'm going to drink, call my sponsor, he says, let's go, he picks me up. I read my first 4-step to him. In that process, I had a white light spiritual experience. I was in the middle of telling this lie about this $26,000 that kind of disappeared accidentally. And I was telling him what I was believing for 3 years. And as I stopped, and I wrote all that down, and as I stopped, I said, no, that's not the real story. And I told him the real story. I mean, we're talking, it was a gray, yucky day, and this guy literally just shot apart. the rays of light came down. We were driving by a church, and these church bells start going off. And then all of a sudden, the worldly clamors came back in, and that all went away. And, you know, I continue to do this step process. I moved down here literally on day 60 of sobriety. I get another sponsor. I'm ready to go on the steps. He's like, well, relax. And I said, well, what do you mean? I just did 1 through 7. I want to keep going. He says, well, we got to start at the beginning. I said, fine. I start at the beginning. I read him the same 4-step. I still don't really know what's going on. I'm about 3 months sober. I start making my amends. There was a good portion of amends, about that many names high, that the guy I had down here and then the other guy said, please don't go make those amends. You're going to hurt yourself if you do that. You're going to get in trouble. I said, cool. Those are pretty big ones. I don't want to go to them either. All right, we got a deal. No problem. I start to really hate Pennsylvania more than I hated it when I left. There was 3 guys my age that I hung out with, 2 of which decided they didn't want to go to AA anymore because it was boring and stupid, and the other one decided, well, whatever, I'll go to a meeting if we can go skateboard, so cool. Our schedules didn't work. I didn't feel like I belonged. You know, I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think I'm working the steps, and I still feel like I don't belong here. I start to get these weird feelings going on in here, like I'm kind of restless, kind of pissy, irritable, you know, not content with what I have. I get angry really easy, frustrated really quickly. I'm miserable, I'm depressed. I can't make a living that I feel is satisfying. And I call my sponsor and I said, I'm going to India. And he says, why are you going to India? And I said, well, I can't handle Pennsylvania anymore, I'm out of here. And he says, well, why don't you just go drink, because it'd probably be a lot easier if you're running from your problems. And I said, well, I got to get back to Vermont because I need to be around the fellowship. And I wanted to be around the fellowship that I craved. And he says, well, all right, then do it. And I said, well, I'm going to look into bus tickets and I'll be out of here by morning. He says, no. You got to do this the responsible way. And what he started to show me that, man, is he showed me how to be responsible. He said, you have coffee commitments that you need to keep until they're over with. And he started to teach me a little bit about responsibility, which I knew nothing about. I did those things. I moved back to Vermont. All those feelings started to come back up inside after being in Burlington for a little while, so I moved to another town, a little smaller town, a little cuter, a little more hippie-ish, right up my alley. Got a job in the field, in the social work field. I figured, you know, I've been landscaping for 9 years. It's time to give this thing a try. I'm about 1.5 years sober. And now I'm like, you know what, screw it. I'm putting a bullet in my head or I'm drinking because this just is not for me. This sobriety stuff is nonsense. I'm like 24 years old. Screw you guys and you're happy, joyous, and free. You know what, maybe it works for you, but not me. Like, I don't know what you got. I'm sick and tired of hearing about your lawnmowers. I'm tired of hearing about your divorce. You've been talking about it for 3 months. You know, get over it. Let's move on. And I would go to my sponsor and I would say, blah, 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 my day, and everyone hates me and I hate everyone. And then he would say, well, just don't drink and go to a meeting. I would say, all right. So I would just not drink and go to a meeting. And then the next day, I would do the same thing. And the day after that, I would do the same thing. Now, the meetings were interesting. They were great for a lot of people. They weren't necessarily the best for me. And I was going to 4 12 and 12 meetings a week, and then driving 45 minutes to my home group, which was about the same size as this. 80 people on an average Friday night. I would get there 1.5 hours early. I had that fellowship, that camaraderie. You know, I shared in the common problem with them. And I had that, and it was good. You know, and we celebrated sobriety in the spirit of the fellowship. And then I would go back home, and then my week would progress. I started going back up to Burlington Friday and Saturday nights. Then I started going on Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights, really seeking the fellowship, because just not drinking and going to these meetings didn't do me a bit of good. I'm trying to sponsor people. I think I made all the amends. Well, there was a few that I was told to do that I just decided I didn't really need to do those. when it was convenient, you know, when I would happen to see those people, I would make those amends. When God was ready, they would just appear in front of me, and I would make that amend. So I really absolutely wanted to drink more than anything in the world, and I was absolutely ready to put a bullet in my head, and I couldn't tell anyone. See, I never stayed sober for a year and a half, and I had so much pride and so much ego. My ego saved my life, because I didn't do either of those things, and I hung onto my seat, and I prayed. I didn't meditate, I prayed, because that's all I knew how to do. I would do my prayers in the morning, and around that time I started to pray at night. Through a series of events, I dusted off my big book. I see this line that says, we leave the outcome in God's hands. And like a lightning bolt, it hit me. Like, I wasn't leaving anything in God's hands. I was leaving everything in my sponsor's hands. I was leaving everything in your hands. I wasn't leaving anything in my Heavenly Father's hands, because I didn't really have a relationship. I had a belief. Right around that time, I get this tape from this guy who's saying all these things from the podium that where was this guy? Like, I was thinking these things. I remember being at a meeting. It was my home group down here, and I said to my sponsor, I said, what are they talking about? What does this have to do with sobriety? And he hits me on the chest, and he says, put the cotton where it belongs, and shut up. And I said, okay, because I didn't know anything. But now it's like a few years later, and I hear this guy saying all these things that I've been thinking for so long. So I find another one of his tapes, and I stalk him, and I call him, and he says, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm like, by this point, I've got the Joe and Charlie tapes, and I'm going through the big book line by line, and it says jump, and I jump, and it says concede, and I concede, and it says, are you willing to believe? And I'm willing to believe, and this is your choice, and okay, I believe that too, and make this decision, okay, I'll do that, write this, and I write that, and he says, all right, then don't worry about it, just keep doing what you're doing, and everything will be all right. And I said, but you don't understand, like, everyone thinks I'm kind of crazy, because now, like, I'm on fire. All right, now I'm, like, an evangelical reformer. I'm running around from the spiritual rooftop. Like, I'm not even, like, I'm taking myself through the steps out of the big book like it was done years and years ago. But, like, nobody is doing that around my area. Like, nobody is on fire with the book. Nobody is doing these things. And here's Ian running around, like, let's go get him. And basically everyone said, go to hell. We don't want to deal with anything you have to talk about. Through this course of time, you know, I move again. I finish making my amends, making amends for $26,000 that disappeared. Now back through the steps again, I've got one amend that will be finished tomorrow, a $12,000 financial amend, and then another one. Can you believe I had a resentment with my credit card company? Because I owe them money. How absurd. So that one I'm going to deal with, and then once that is done, I'm going to be current again. And I start doing these things, and like, what do you know, I get free. Like, more than just, like, if we're painstaking at this phase of the development, like, more than those promises came true. Like, you know, I was experiencing a new freedom and a new happiness. I was able to sit alone in perfect peace and ease. I was able to feel the living presence of my Creator come into my life in a way that I never believed was going to be possible. And it's because I went through these steps. Like, I didn't even know what it meant to be an alcoholic until I was a year and a half sober. Like, I would sit in these rooms and say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but I didn't know. So, you know, what I've done now is now I start to find these newcomers, and I don't necessarily preach in a meeting or tell them what they need to do or need not to do, but I grab them after the meeting, like, this great opportunity I had last night. I was missing my home group. So what's the book say? It says, when we're having problems, go find a newcomer to work with. I grab this guy, I ask him, do you even know what it is to be an alcoholic? He's talking about how he's stumbling around step three and step two, yet he doesn't even know what it is to be step one. He doesn't even know what it is to be a hopeless alcoholic suffering from a physical craving, a mental obsession, and worse off, the spiritual manageability that comes back when I'm sober. See, nobody told me that. Like, I thought the unmanageability was the fact that I was arrested 9 times, the fact that I got in fistfights with my dad, the fact that I barely squeaked my way through high school and through college. I didn't know that the spiritual malady was on the inside. No wonder I'm driving 45 minutes 3 days a week to stay sober on the fellowship, because I can't sit still. Like, I go to these step meetings and I hear like, oh, this is a great step. I really, wow, this is awesome. We should really talk about this, and would be great if I was doing it. But they talk about their dad. I'm not hearing anyone talking about practical experience of working the 12 steps. I hear a lot of theories about the 12 steps. What I found is there is this little line, and it says the spiritual life is not a theory. It's something I have to live. It's something I have to do. It's something I have to take out into all aspects of my life. Service, unity, and recovery, three sides of the triangle, 36 principles, not just 12. Not just sitting in a meeting, not just sitting here talking to you and being a good boy, and then going home, kicking the dog, telling my girlfriend to go piss off, and going to bed. Like, I have to take this thing everywhere I go and with everything I do. I need to take it to work. I need to not gossip about my coworkers. So what happens is I get into these steps, and what it's like today is I live these steps, and I try my best to live these steps. So step one, I find that I'm physically powerless, because when I put it in, I can't not drink. I find that I'm mentally powerless, because when I say I'm not going to drink, I drink. And to top it off, I can't control it. I find out that I have this unmanageability that comes back at any time of sobriety. Doesn't matter if you're here 25 years or if you're here 2 days. Alright? It comes back. I look at the second step, and today my second step is not, do I believe that God can restore me to sanity, but today my second step is, do I believe that God can take me further than where I am today? Do I believe that my Heavenly Father is going to come into my life and maybe move me into a place that I didn't possibly dream of being? I mean, my life is pretty good. I'm getting a 4.0 and a master's degree right now. I'm halfway through. I got a beautiful woman about to move into my house tomorrow. I have this gorgeous condo that's like 5 minutes walking distance to Lake Champlain on the beach. Like, my life materially is good. Inside, guess what? I fall asleep 5 minutes after my head hits the pillow. Boom, done. Out. Do I believe that God can take me further than that? As I went back through the steps, my second step choice was, yes, I do. I do believe that God is everything. And if God is everything, then God is going to take me further. I moved to the third step. I get on my knees. I do that decision, make that decision again, which is my will in my life. When I went through the steps at a year and a half of sobriety, I had to look up the word will in the dictionary. Nobody told me my will was my thinking. I always, whenever I hear people talking about, I'm struggling with the third step, the first thing I ask them is, do you know what your will is? And you'll always get a few different responses, but the rarest response is, yeah, it's my thinking. See, I didn't know what my will was. I thought it was just this, like, thing that, like, came with me. You know, I had to get a dictionary out, and what Webster tells me is that it's my thinking. It's my thought process. That's why I got to turn my will over, because my thought process says that this time it's going to be okay that I take a drink. That this time I can be sober and go on a senseless series of sprees and start buying sneakers like galore. I can start tattooing myself like crazy because I'm not content with what I have. I mean, I've experienced this manifestation of self. I got $5,000 worth of tattoos on my body. I turned around almost a little over a year ago. I turned around and in my bedroom I got 80 pairs of Nikes stacked up. Boom. We're talking a senseless series of sprees. Like, this stuff creeps back in and it comes back in. I know people who go on sex sprees. They got a beautiful wife at home, yet they're off with this girl, and they're off with this girl, and they're off with this girl. Or they don't even want to get a wife, they just want to be off with these different girls. I know people who can't stop going to the gym. Hours and hours and hours a week at the gym. 45-minute workout 3 days a week. The health experts say that's good. 2 hours a day, 7 days a week. A little obsessive, but my body has to look perfect. I need this to look good. And I start controlling the outside things. So I have to move into these things and I have to look at this stuff. I start writing. My third step talks about how I'm driven by self-delusion, self-seeking, fear. What I didn't know is all those self-delusion, those self-seeking, those fears, that self-pity. That's the unmanageability of my first step. And then I look at it again in my third step, and then I look at it again in my fourth step, then I talk about it in my fifth step, then I ask God and I get willing in 6 and 7, and then I go make amends for my unmanageability in the first step. If you're sick and tired of working on your character defects, go make amends for them. my last inventory, I had maybe 4 coworkers that I gossiped about. Now, I'm not saying just run out to these people. I'm not saying run out and make all the amends to your drug dealers. I'm not saying go into these places and say, hey, I stole $1,400 from you. I'm not saying that. I'm saying talk to your sponsor. But what I did was I went to these people that I worked with and I talked to them about how I gossiped. And not only did I talk to them, I talked to the other people that I gossiped to them about. And I said that those things that I said were wrong because I had unjustified resentments. Well, what do you know? I haven't gossiped to date. It's only been 2 months. But, alright, but I haven't done it to date because when everyone else starts to gossip, I think, whoa, you don't want to have to go to those people. Like, you want to talk about behavior therapy that they should have been teaching me in therapy. Like, that's the stuff I need to do. So what happens is I make amends to this one woman, and the other day she calls me. Now, I've been telling her, I hate saying it, I work in treatment. Right? And what we do is it's a crock sometimes, all right? It's a waste. For some people, it's really, really good, and there's a lot of really useful things we tell people. But for other people, it's just a waste of time. And she's really big on it. She has a choice and this, that, and the other thing, and well, her problem is this, and it's not this. And she calls me the other day. She came to my home group's anniversary and heard the speaker, and what do you know, she identified. Sober 4 or 5 years, never went to an AA meeting, had some decent bouts with alcohol, through the course of her 4 years of sobriety, and she calls me to qualify her as an alcoholic. I don't tell her she is or she's not. I present the information of what it is to be an alcoholic. She starts crying. I let her know of a good woman to go talk to. She goes and talks to that woman, and now I don't know what she's doing. But these are the things that get to happen because I go make amends for my unmanageability, really. My problems are of my making, not of yours, they're of mine. So I move, I get into the 10th step and I watch Ask and Turn. I've got a major, major, major problem with my ego. I probably have the biggest ego of anyone you'll ever meet. And I don't say that because I'm proud of it. I'm saying that because it's the truth. And I'm not proud of it. I was talking to my sponsor yesterday. I have a sponsor and I have a spiritual advisor. I was talking to my sponsor. He's been sober 27 years. He knows the big book more than anyone else that I know. And he was going to give a talk on step 2 out of the big book. And I said, oh, well, you should say this and this and this. And he just started hitting me with stuff. And I mean, I could just like feel myself drop. And he says, you need to practice watching and listening. See, I didn't know about watching and listening. And I said, well, what about last year? See, what happened last year was when I celebrated 3 years of sobriety, I also made an agreement with God that I wasn't going to share in any meetings unless I was called on or asked to speak. Because what happened is I was on such a spiritual hilltop, I couldn't hear even a message of hope in AA anymore. All I was hearing was you guys didn't know what you're talking about, and oh, call me because I know what I'm talking about. That's what I heard. And then I would say what I thought was so profound, and then I would sit and think about what I should have said, which would have been even more profound. Or what, if I were said this to you right now, that would be great. So for a year, I don't share. Alright? Now a lot of people say, well, how are you going to do your 12 step? What happened over the course of that year, my 11th step and my 12 step were catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence, in the dimension of time. I now no longer need to raise my hand and be the most profound guy in the room and let you know how great and spiritual I am. I don't need to see anything. See, I went from sponsoring a good amount of guys to a whole hell of a lot of guys from not sharing. What happened is I started to listen. And I guess my sponsor thinks I need to watch and listen some more. But I started to listen and I started to go to people after the meeting. And I would hear someone talk, and instead of, you know, just trying to sound really great and cool and wonderful and spiritual, I would go to them after the meeting and say, hey, why don't we go get some coffee? Hey, why don't you come over here? Let's talk for a few minutes. And we start to talk, and we start to talk about what this spiritual malady is. We start to talk about what this hopeless condition is. I sit in prayer and meditation, and I ask God things like, please show me any unfinished amends that I have. Please show me how I can be of maximum service to you and the people about me. Please give me a vision of your will. And I move, and he catapults me, and he shifts me, and he moves me here, and he pushes me here. And now I have the opportunity to work with a lot of people and do a lot of service work. I got to help bring another fellowship to Burlington, which I'm slowly backing out of, to get some of our addicts a little more involved with the big book, just like our AA literature talks about. Get these guys help. Get these guys started. All you AAs who believe that we should only be talking about alcohol here, which I believe as well, if you don't like it, do something about it. Stop complaining about it and go start another meeting that uses the big book to let these guys talk about the things that are going to take them back out. Because I know in my experience is that when I only heard about one thing, I didn't hear about the other thing, and I started to think, well, maybe if I just do a little of that, it'll be okay. And see, now that's not the case, now is it? I mean, you know it's not. I know it's not. So we brought another fellowship to Burlington. I'm slowly getting out of dealing with that. It's been going for about a year. It's doing so-so. The 10th, 11th, and 12th step disciplines, I do not believe are maintenance steps. I believe they are growth steps, so I can grow in effectiveness and understanding with my Heavenly Father. So I get to be put in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, where sanity has returned, where I no longer swear off booze. When I lose sight of my first step, and I lose sight of the fact that maybe, you know what, I do have a choice. Maybe I don't need to work the steps, I don't do those other things. When I have a choice and I don't need to work the steps, I don't need to go finish my amends and I don't need to do a four-step, because if I got a choice, what do I need to do this other stuff for? But today, I'm pretty clear that I don't have a choice. I don't have power and I don't have control unless I make that second step choice and God comes into my life and I let my Heavenly Father take me into a place where I get to be of service to other people. My 10th, 11th, and 12th step disciplines look like 10th step, I get out of the street when the truck is coming. I know some people who do it at night. I know some people who do it in the morning. I do it when it's happening, if possible. I don't have the luxury of taking a resentment with me for another 8 hours until I get home and can write about it. If something is bothering me 3 days in a row, I do write about it. The 11th step, I do what the book tells me to do at night. I do what it tells me to do in the morning. In the morning, I put that stuff into a series of prayers. I have some prayers. I do some quiet meditation. I do 540 mantras. I do some yoga. I do about 20 minutes of silent meditation. My morning, I call it my 11th step devotion, lasts about 40 minutes. If God is the most important thing, and some of my spiritual advisor, his buddies, often say this, but if God is the most important thing, how much time a day do you spend with God? I don't count the meeting necessarily as being with God. I count the silent time. Now, obviously, my Creator is with me all day long wherever I go. My big book tells me the only place I can find God is here and now, in the present moment, in the fourth dimension of existence, the dimension of time. Through meditation, my 12th step goes. We used to have a circle and a triangle. A lot of us still use it. I still use it. In the triangle, one of the sides says service, which is really talking about taking the 12 concepts out to all levels of our life, taking service out to all levels of our life and all aspects of our life. For me, I have found that service is living in the fourth dimension of existence. I have found that service is living in the sunlight of the Spirit. Because if the Spirit is service, then service is Spirit. And when I get to give to you freely, then I get in return. Chuck C. always talked about, it's my business to do my Father's business, and it's my Father's business to take care of me. The more I move, and the more I get rid of things, the more I get. I went from 80 pairs of sneakers to about 20. There's some that I just couldn't part with. But what happens is I get rid of these things, and I don't necessarily sell them for the prices I should be selling them for. I give them to people who need them. or I sell them pretty freaking cheap. That's not 12-step work, that's because I need to get rid of, in the world of the spirit, less is more. Material things don't fill that hole in here. I love all of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the interesting meetings, and I love the really good meetings. I have found it much more beneficial not to go to quote-unquote solution-based meetings. I don't need to be there. I have no one to help there. Everyone knows the book. Everyone's doing the deal. What do I need to be there for? So I can have my ego say something cooler than theirs. I need to be out on the firing line of life, and with those motives, my creator then takes care of me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely love it. This program has given me a life that I never could have dreamed of. I had an amazing week with my mother and my father. I got to celebrate Mother's Day with her, my grandmother, my dad's birthday. We did a whole little deal. I got to weed whack for 4 hours with my dad. I got to, you know, do these things. I don't have to be sick and suffering one freaking day at a time. I absolutely love this program with the bottom of my heart. I love every bit of it, the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. I'm actually getting ready to go through the traditions and concepts formally with someone, and I'm really looking forward to that. I lost the majority of my judgments of other people through the traditions. Because if our common unity comes first, I have no right to be gossiping about you or anybody else, or anybody else's meeting. Because without the group, I can't stay sober. Without the unity of AA, I'm lost. I really thank you guys for letting me come down here. I thank you for being a part of my life, and I'll see you soon.